Eventually, I had put some clothes in the washer. But then, do I put the liquid right on the clothes? Wait, is this going to stain everything? Oh God, and the bleach smells like it's going to disintegrate all my clothes on the spot. Needless to say, I put the bleach directly on the clothes and then put the liquid fabric softener right into the dryer. When I pulled out the Dalmatian spotted jeans and the gummy towels, I knew I had done it all wrong. But there was always a next time, and the next time would include Justine. I clearly needed a tutorial. She came with me and gave me some tips and directions. It was a revelation. Of course! It all made so much sense! Wow! The whole movie went from 80s comedy to glorious black and white. Yes, the opposite. But that's what I wanted in this new world I was creating for myself. It was the romance I was waiting for. Think old French movie. Every weekend, I would look forward to this ritual. I didn't feel alone there. I could be domestic, read my book, eat some Chinese food from the place next door in a carton with chopsticks. Everything fell into place, and I got so good at laundry, it became a point of pride. I loved stain removal. The art of getting your whites white, pouring in my fabric softener and bleach so that I was more of a chef making a stew, getting the ratios and flavors just right. And once I had finished my classic novel, I was excited to go to the bookstore and get a new one. I read books by Tolstoy, Jane Austen, Joan Didion, Bukowski, John Fante, and Kurt Vonnegut, The Fountainhead, To Kill a Mockingbird. I read everything. What was my next adventure going to be? As I roamed the book aisles, I had a revelation that I had dropped out of school. Once I was emancipated, I just simply dropped out. Oh my God! I had a pit in my stomach again. What was I going to do? I had been on film sets my whole life, receiving 3 hours a day of tutoring. I hated when I went back to school because the kids were merciless, a chapter you are supposed to face, but fuck it, I had enough to face at this point. I wasn't going back voluntarily. But what? I didn't want to be uneducated. Oh my God, oh my God! Just when I had mastered laundry, I was panicking all over again. What did I want to learn? What was my calling? Tears. I don't know. I know acting, but that's gone for now, and I don't know if they will have me back. People thought I was crazy, even though I wasn't. I just grew up too fast. Ah! Okay, pull it together. The walls of the book started to envelop me. I looked at all the bindings and the jackets and the shelves and the titles and the fonts, and I started to come back to earth. The book jacket soothed me, a ritual I enjoy to this day. Books. Book smart. I can read. I love books. Everyone seems to brag about being well-read. Books not only give me pleasure, they are good for me. Healthy. Screw it! I'll create my own school. If I can live on my own, I can self-educate too. I will buy a dictionary and study every word. I will steep myself in all the things I love. I love laundry. I love books. I love music. I think I like art. Go to museums quick. I decided right then and there that I would not be defeated. Failure was not an option. And I would create my own curriculum. And so I did just that. I read, I cleaned, I worked. Oh God, work. Back at the coffee house, my boss was having another "you suck at this" moment with me. And as I was explaining another thing I had messed up, he looked at me with those saucer eyes of his one last time and said to me with clenched teeth, "Why don't you go out there and find yourself?" And even though he was half trying to get rid of me, he was half right. I looked around. This wasn't it. This wasn't my destiny. I quit that day. went back to my apartment, went right up to Justine's door, and knocked with fervor. Word of the day from my annotated dictionary. Until she opened it. If I found us a place to live, would you ever want to move out and be roommates and get the hell out of this shithole? She looked at me. Well, Darren and I just broke up, so sure, I'm in. Yay! A roommate! This might actually become fun! I ran to my place and started circling apartments for rent in the paper. Listening to the cats fighting in the alley, I looked out my window and waited, as I did each morning, for the sun to come up and tell me everything was going to be okay. And it was. I wasn't scared anymore. I was ready. And even though it was only laundry, it taught me how to tackle everything moving forward. You fall in love, and you try to conquer by way of mastering it. Taurus. When I woke up in the hospital, I glanced over and took a deep look at my new baby girl, who I had decided with my husband to name Frankie. She looked peaceful and sweet after her journey into the world. What a ride, huh, kid? I watched her, and after a little while, she really looked at me. She had need in her eyes. My first daughter, Olive, was born independent and has never given me that needy look to this day. As much as I loved having this moment, something felt strange. I started feeling like a roller coaster free fall was happening in my stomach. My head clenched tight and tears started pouring out of me uncontrollably. Then came the sounds, because I couldn't keep them inside. The wailing sobs were loud, and as I gasped for air, it hit me. Frankie looked like my mom. Like my mother, Frankie is also a Taurus in the astrological realm of life. And here she lay, looking at me. And I felt so many emotions that I simply could not classify them individually. This was a mosaic of things that made no sense together. Yet if I broke it down, it might help me stop convulsing. Okay, number one, I asked myself, what is my worst fear? Well, the answer is easy. My biggest emotional button in my life is my mother. I am a girl trying to be a woman and being a mother first now, but I was being dragged and hogtied back to childhood stuff that maybe I had never put to bed. Okay, I said to myself, you know that this is your biggest issue, but is it having a girl of your own and the fear of repeating anything that took place in your own childhood? I calmed myself by thinking through the last year and a half with Olive, my Libra, and how my life is as safe and consistent, stimulating and loving as it could possibly be. There is proof of an existence that quells my worst fear. Okay, next. Is it that she looks like her? No, because she looks like me, too. And yes, of course, we are both going to resemble people in our families on both sides. But when Olive was born, she had the biggest, most beautiful, wide-apart, cat-shaped mega-eyes that there was already a point of difference. She actually seemed to take a bit after my mother-in-law, Coco, whom I cannot begin to describe how much I love, worship, and am simply in awe of. Coco is elegant, kind, smart, worldly, and a great, great, great mother. Her maiden name is Franco, and it was an inspiration for Frankie. But Frankie was looking more like my family here in this hospital in Los Angeles, California, on April 22, 2014, and I was facing something I had managed to avoid with Olive. I was being asked if I could dig deep and heal this pain from the relationship I had with my Taurus mother while I was looking at my Taurus daughter. I was born in 1975 to a single mother who was doing her best while still being young herself. She would actually never tell me her age, one of many strange mysteries I had with this woman, but I gather she was in her mid-20s when she had me. Still very much a hedonist, she brought me up with zero protection, zero consistency, and as is known, we parted ways when I was 14 and we have rarely spoken since. I still support her, and I must know that she is taken care of or I simply cannot function. I am grateful to this woman for bringing me into this world, and it would crush me to know that she was in need anywhere. It is not who I am to harbor any anger for the fact that our life together was so incredibly unorthodox. I want only to say thank you to her, because I love my life and it takes every step to get where you are. And if you are happy, then God bless the hard times it took you to get there. No life is without them, so what are yours and what did you do with the lessons? That is the only way to live. Another philosophy I have is that nothing is taken away without being replaced. And with that truth enters the love of my life when I was 19 years old in Seattle, Washington. I was at a bar with friends. I was making a movie up there, and it was the 90s, a very wild and inspired time for music and culture. But movies were the only thing on my mind. I had done a Western film about 2 years before, and the whole experience made me want to make movies about girls. Capable girls. Girls who want to do what boys do but still want to love the boys and want to run and tell their girlfriends about it and have each other's backs. I was figuring out who I wanted to be in the world, and I would sit around making mixtapes and trying to dream up what I could be in life. So there I was, sitting in a booth, and my friend Jim said, "By the way, my sister Nan is coming to meet us. She'll be here for a few days." "Great!" And in walks this blonde-haired, blue-eyed, big-teeth Breck girl with the most winning, warm, ingratiating smile I had ever seen. Nancy Javonin was a girl who sang the songs of John Denver. She worked on planes as a flight attendant. She did semesters in Costa Rica and England. She worked on a dude ranch in Wyoming. She grew up in San Francisco and New Hampshire. Her life was about adventure and trying things. She was organized like no one I had ever met. She charted and diagrammed everything and was a great planner and loved board vision. You would hear her say things like, "Slow and steady wins the race." And she loved words like "earn." She would become my partner in business. She would take me in like a sister. She would change my whole life in so many important ways. Nancy Javonin is the replacement for the absence of family. She was my gift in life, and she is a Taurus. Nan and I would actually start to articulate our vision when we started with our company, Flower Films. We wanted to tell stories. In the era of the early 90s power suit woman, we vowed we would never abandon our JanSport backpacks. But what we would do was constant homework. We studied everything. We made lists on everything. We read everything. And we built relationships with people we admired and respected rather than party with the beautiful people. We created a cozy house-like environment at Flower Films on Sunset Boulevard. Nan's office was warm and truly lived in. That's where all our conversations and dreams took place. Her office was warm and utterly organized. Everything was labeled. Inbox, outbox, pictures hanging on the walls, pillows, and mantras by Abraham Lincoln and little frames placed on her desk. My office was a case study in disorganization with papers all over my desk and no feng shui whatsoever. We did Christmas cards every year together, and it felt like we were creating traditions I just never had. In life outside the office, we would road trip across America in an RV. We would travel the world. We would adopt dogs. But the most important thing to know is that Nan never let me get away with anything. You're late, and your time management sucks. You are selfish, and when you walk into a room apologizing for being late, you are making it all about you. You're causing yourself and everyone else distractions and anxieties, and if you were just on time, you could avoid all this drama for everyone.
Jesus.
I was always hurt in the moment. One time, I called her to tell her I wanted to direct. You're not ready. You're too disorganized, and you're still late, and you cannot waste people's money and time. That is not leadership, and directors are leaders. I told her I would call her back, and I hung up and burst into tears. Don't ever drink and drive. Vote. All of these wonderful things my parents should have taught me. I was so grateful for her tough love because it let me know time and again that she cared. And for the record, I was never late when I directed, thanks to her. She was willing to fight to help me get to my better self. No matter what we go through, we always come out stronger. I have spent most holidays of my life with her family. She was the maid of honor at my wedding, and she is the family I never had until I made my own. And she still is. 22 years, and she has been my beacon of light and goodness. She's also the most fun person ever. And if you're looking for the best advice on love, look no further. We've made many films about relationships, and on one particular one called Fever Pitch, she met her husband, Jimmy Fallon, and the perfect girl met the perfect guy. And although she hates it when I call her perfect, to me she is. Most of all, Nan was always there to teach me that if you stay emotionally balanced and responsible in life, you are able to have the real joy, the earned joy. Back when we were just starting out, she lived in a small bachelorette apartment in West Hollywood. I remember walking in and seeing a yellow sign on her fridge that said, "Happiness is a choice." I stared at it. I loved it. But it took me 20 years to realize that it's the word choice that is so powerful. You must make that choice all the time. And the people I follow in life are the kind of people who are capable of making that choice all the time, consistently. She would also tell me that when I felt lost, the best thing to do was write. As a lover of journals, this really spoke to me. And wouldn't you know it, another lady I love, Kate Capshaw Spielberg, Scorpio, got me a 5-year journal after Olive was born. And when I was a brand new mother and experiencing fear and worry like I have never felt, this pink leather-bound journal was delivered to my door with a note that read, "Start writing to your daughter and keep it up every day. Love, Kate." I held this care package of a journal in my hand and I thought of what Nan always said. And I have written in it every day of my life since then, chronicling Frankie and Olive's lives, and when my daughters are older, it will be my gift to them. So who was I in this hospital room? Was I a damaged kid with mother issues? Or was I a woman who had gone out there and fought hard for my lessons and actually found great role models? Great people like Nan have led me and lifted me out of feeling helpless or scared and given me power. Now, I need to pass on this wisdom and strength. Was I going to cower in this room when this kid, this beautiful new baby, needs me? Hell no. I got up, so sore and groggy, and I picked up my baby Taurus, and I kissed her face over and over. I vowed, just as I did with Olive, that I would always be her warrior. I am their Pisces mother, mother of dragons. I am strong. I have learned. I love love and have plenty to give. It is my powerful destiny that I am supposed to raise two good girls into two great women. All right. Here we go, my beautiful little girls. Here we go. The School of E.T. In 1982, in Culver City, California, I was auditioning for a film called Poltergeist. The producer was taking the auditions because the director was unavailable. His name was Steven Spielberg. And when I went into the room, we started talking. I guess I did the same thing with him that I was starting to do with other people, which is lie. I was six, and I had basically developed a crazy alternate life in which I had skills like cooking and all kinds of brothers. I had zero siblings, and of course, I didn't know how to make my way around a kitchen. But the biggest thing in life that was currently taking up all my time was my so-called drumming. I was in an imaginary band called the Purple People Eaters, and my style was more punk rock than pop. In my room at Poinsettia Place, I had posters all over my bedroom wall of Blondie and Superman, Kiss, which gave me nightmares, but I insisted on keeping it up. And of course, Pippi Longstocking. She was my ultimate hero. She could hold up a horse with her superhuman strength. She could show you how to have fun when you didn't exactly have family around. She could clean with brushes on her feet like ice skates, and she loved to travel. Every day in Pippi's world was a chance to go down the Nile or fight pirates. She made you feel like there was nothing you couldn't do if you put your mind to it. Of course, I had told myself somewhere in my head that a healthy imagination is a good thing, and girls that rock are the way to go. So when I met Steven, I was in this state where the sky was the limit on what a girl could do. And he rewarded that with telling me I wasn't right for this movie. My heart sank. But there was good news. He himself was directing a film called A Boy's Life. And would I come in and meet on that instead? Sure. I calculated in my head that I was too colorful for this project, but maybe his other one I was more suited for. I left the office and figured that if I got a call back for that film, I would know he was serious. And if I never heard from him again, well, I would know he was just being nice, and I would try to capture the next job in my butterfly net with my skills and my stories. My mom got a call a few weeks later from Marcy Leeroth, who was the woman working with Mike Fenton and Jane Feinberg, the casting directors for Steven's film. Well, I thought this guy kept his word. How cool. And back in I went to meet with him. Now I was thinking, I have already told him my usual rhetoric and wild tales. What am I going to wow him with now? I started working up some bits on the way over. I was very confident and precocious at that age. Now, when I walk into a room, I survey it with humility and take in how I might best disarm people and yet bring them together. But that morning when I was six, walking into a room with four adults, I had swagger. They all sat around observing me and asking me questions. I was a dry-witted, lying, thieving six-year-old, and I just wanted to win the job and go on the adventure. Jobs cured the loneliness that I wouldn't have known how to classify but strongly felt. But here, right now, I had an audience. And I wanted to make the most of it. So after my made-up tales and small talk that was larger than life, I was mostly directing it to Steven because I knew that he was buying it. But once it was winding down, they all turned to each other and started talking as if I wasn't in the room. They do that in auditions, and you're expected to entertain yourself and look so distracted that you can't hear their hushed tones 4 feet away. I sat there wondering when they would turn their attention back to me. I felt small, scared all of a sudden. What if they said thank you and that was it? Which had happened plenty of times to me. I had been acting since I was 11 months old. My mother was working nights, but she thought I could make money during the day. It started with a Gainsburger puppy chow audition. According to her, there were so many babies in the waiting room, they were hanging off the chandeliers. As if there were fancy chandeliers in some dingy audition hall. I think I get a lot of my euphemisms from my mom, as she had a great way of analogizing and describing things. But there we were, and my dirt poor mother was thinking I had no chance in hell at landing this gig and bringing in some extra money for us. She worked 2 jobs already, and we were struggling, which is why she brought me to this crazy place to begin with. So apparently when I went into the room, all the people, the director, and the casting agents were sitting around and I was not unlike the puppy that they brought in. I was being observed and the goal was for them to choose me and take me home. So I started playing with the puppy, standard fare, probably not too different from what the other babies who didn't totally freak out did. And just then, when they were chalking me up as another decent non-flipping-out child, the dog bit me. Everyone stopped. Oh, shit. My mother said she could see the word lawsuit on everyone's frozen and horrified faces. The room went and stayed silent. I looked at everyone, probably more scared by the looks on their faces and the energy that hung sour and perilous. The air was thick with fear and anticipation. What was going to happen to the baby who just got bit by the damn dog? That moment of purgatory was probably when I realized in my 11-month-old soul that you could conduct the energy in a room. Because what I did next was throw my head back and laugh. As everyone started to actually breathe again, they took my cue, supposedly, and started to clap and cheer too. Again, probably out of sheer relief that I was not hurt in taking them to court. And my mom said that they all started animatedly talking to one another and slapping knees and wiping foreheads. Needless to say, I got the job. And my budding commercial and TV movie career began. Now, it was not all throwing back heads and laughing moments. I quickly learned that this was a cattle call business and you win some and you lose some. There were rooms of nice people and there were rooms that just wanted you in and out. There were rooms that no matter what little vaudeville act I pulled out of my hat, they were not amused. And I clearly wasn't what they were looking for. But the worst kind was the room where I could tell I did well, but at the end of the day, there was just someone else who did better or was more right. And I would go home feeling so high, and yet I would get the call that the part was going to someone else, and they just said, thank you anyway. For a kid, those are hard calls. Rejection is a lesson you usually learn later in life, but my mom would take me to McDonald's or something and I'd feel better. Come to think of it, it's probably why I associate healing pain with delicious fatty foods. It really does work. Back in this moment, though, I wondered which way the pendulum would swing. I could tell I'd done well, but how well? Eventually, they turned back to me and asked if I would come back. Steven said I would have to go on tape this time, and I was like, whatever, if I have to hang upside down and rip out my own nails to do this all over again, I would. I hope I didn't actually put it that way, but that was how I felt. Again, I was a hyper-imaginative kid with nothing to lose. And so I came back. In fact, Stephen kept having me come back again and again. Each time I felt more like the Fonz and less like a scared kid. There must be something I'm hawking that he likes. I was excited and encouraged. The final audition, he wanted to see if I could scream. I probably said something to the effect of, "Watch this." Again, I was much cockier at 6 than I am at 40. And so they turned the tape on, and I watched the wheels of the audio record go round and round, and I waited for Stephen's signal. He did, and then I did. I screamed, and I screamed so loud that I broke the device, and the tape stopped. Again, the room went silent. Oh, God. Had I done something wrong? Was I screwed? Would they all turn to each other in a good mood, or was this my lead into the thank you but no thank you phone call? Stephen smiled, and that was it. A few days later, the phone call came from Marcy to my mom, and my mom told me, "You got the job. We would start in a few weeks." I froze. And then I ran to my room and looked at all of my poster friends on the wall. Kiss and Blondie seem especially hats off to you, with their tongues out and rocker hand gestures. Superman seemed like a proud puffin with a "you can do it" look. But Pippi seemed the most excited. She had that wry smile and that mischievous look in her eye. I felt like I could lift a horse in that moment, just like her. When we got to the first day, I went through wardrobe fittings, and they showed me this little tiny dressing room that would be mine, my little home, for the next 3 months. We were at Laird Studios in Culver City, which was the old David O. Selznick studio. It was quaint and more intimate than other studios. Instead of trailers, you had bungalows. And then they led me to a little schoolhouse, and they said I would start to clock in my 3 hours a day, which is the requirement still today. Under child labor laws, anyone under 16 must attend 3 hours of school a day and work no more than 9.5 hours, a rule I sorely miss as an adult when I am on set for the 17th hour of the day and still going. I will sit on the set and mutter under my breath when I see children being let go. Friggin' children's hours, ha! Because now I just want to go home. But back then, you would have to pry me away. When my time was up, I was devastated, depressed all the way home, only to wake up and run back. And that was what we did. Every day, my mom would drive me to work, and I would go into the little schoolhouse and join the other kids. Now, the kids on this film were Henry Thomas, who played Elliot, and Robert McNaughton, who played Michael. I finally had the brothers I made up in my imagination. They were the best. They teased me just like an annoying little sister, and I had never been happier. Then there were the D&D boys, which was the name of their gang in the movie, which came from the game Dungeons and Dragons. They were Sean Fry, C. Thomas Howell, and Casey Martell. They were super cool, and I was in awe of them. There were also the kids in the ET costumes, a young girl and a young boy, each about 13. They did not have legs, and they walked on their hands instead. The tone was that they were like capable superhero circus performers, and so there was no somber attitude. They were part of the gang, and they, too, were super cool. Matt, the boy, went around with his body on a skateboard and was a total badass, whereas the girl was very sweet and girly and seemed not one bit different than any of us. Someone who was different in life, but not in our schoolhouse group, was Pat Bylon, the world's smallest man. He was 34 inches tall, and I loved him. I felt like he was a friend just made for me, even though I was fully aware that he was his own person with a full life who went to his own home every night. We were all like misfits from the Island of Lost Toys, or maybe I pictured us more like the Wizard of Oz gang, the ones who played the Munchkins and apparently wrecked the Culver Hotel, which was one block away, while shooting. A visual that always makes me smile. I like to think of us as them. We would get in crazy food fights in the commissary, one of them started by Stephen and me. We would play games, make bets, and just hang. One day, on Halloween, we all got dressed up over our costumes. I was a gypsy, and Robert McNaughton was Nixon, and Henry was a clown. But we were all hearing rumors that Stephen, the biggest kid of all, the most playful, the most unpatronizing leader, was about to show us all up. We waited. It was quiet in the schoolhouse. We were all doing our schoolwork, and in walks this old lady. And for a second, until our eyes adjusted, we wondered who she was. Well, it was Stephen, in full drag, and we all jumped up and attacked him. And we escorted him to set like a moving wave of groupies in Stephen's ocean. To say that we loved him is the understatement of the world. We didn't love him because it was our job. We loved him because he was like Peter Pan. He believed in us. And for the first time in our lives, we realized our own potential through him. I have never had an experience like it. And when the filming was coming to a close, I was so upset. We were shooting the end of the film in the rainforest where E.T. is going home. Stephen shot most of the film in sequence, something no one has the luxury of doing anymore because of schedules and budgets, which is a complete shame because often now you shoot the end of a film at the beginning or go so out of sequence that you can't find which way is up because you are guessing how you will feel about things after a journey that hasn't yet taken place. Not to mention, you work with people in tight chunks rather than the sprawling nature of the months or years the story actually calls for. On this movie, we got to know each other, bond, become a family, fall in love with E.T. and each other. So when it was ending, it was truly high stakes for all of us. Stephen never let us fake anything. Tears or joy or sarcasm. He made us all be real. And that incredible film that he made was all there on the day. Very little special effects considering. We were not acting to tennis balls standing in for E.T. that would be placed later by CGI. He was very much there in the room. He was present. I knew myself that he wasn't real, but it didn't matter. He was alive in the electric sense of the word. I saw the cords coming out of him. I saw kids taking off his head to breathe while in the E.T. suit, but it didn't shake my belief in him. In fact, the fact that he wasn't real meant that he could keep secrets, and I could tell him anything. I often sat with him alone while the crew had gone out for lunch. I would wrap a handkerchief around his neck and eat with him. I cared for him. I didn't need him to have feelings in order to actually care about his feelings. So when we were in those woods saying goodbye, I was a mess. I couldn't stop crying. It was working for the scene because E.T. was going home, and then I got rumblings that they needed another day to shoot. All of the sudden, the idea that this would not be all ending as soon as I thought cheered me up so much, Stephen came over and told me that I needed to be upset, not happy. And I followed instruction, secretly relieved for this not to be going away in hours, but days. When you end a film, especially as an actor, that's it. You are sent home, back to normal life, as if it was all a dream. A boy's life was over, and I thought that I would never hear or see anything about it again. Much to my relief, I had become so close with Stephen that he accepted my wish, conveyed by my mother, to have him be like a godfather to me. He stepped up to the plate. He took me in, a girl who needed a father, and it meant the world to me. And he was such a good father figure, too. consistent, caring, strict, wholesome, nurturing. And most of all, it was relaxed and easy. It became normal to spend weekends at his house, and it was the safest place and time I knew. I thank God for his care and guidance because it truly made the biggest difference in my life. And he, single-handedly, changed my life. And that is the truth. And I was about to find out what that meant. After months of silence on the film, we heard that the name was going to be changed to E.T., the Extraterrestrial. Okay, great. Then we heard that people were really loving it. It was as if there was some kind of buzz in the air. Again, this was 1982, so you really had to search for your information. But one day, on the TV, it showed that people were lined up around the block to see the film, and the ones coming out of the film were crying and full of joy and emotions. It was becoming a phenomenon. Days went by, and then the news wasn't hard to come by at all. E.T. was breaking records. Our little experience was becoming a worldwide freakout. And so, to ride the wave, the studio sent us all on a world tour. I remember my mom rushing me out of school to go to the federal building to get a passport so that we could travel. My picture was taken in my school uniform, and I had the biggest smile on my face ever. All of a sudden, I was a girl with a stamped passport to my life's wildest adventures. I was in Germany, Norway, Paris, England. I met Princess Diana and got to present her an E.T. doll. And I looked as any 7-year-old meeting a real-life princess would look. I was trying to keep my jaw off the floor and my eyes in my head. I loved her, and Stephen made sure I bowed properly as I handed her this token stuffed animal. The last stop on our tour was Japan. That was the world that seemed the most exotic and far away from where I lived. However, Stephen had been versing me on sushi all summer, so I was excited to eat the food. Stephen loved to freak people out with food, hence the food fights or a game he called seafood. He would put food in his mouth and then open it and say, "Seafood!" And we all howled. He would dangle clams and then slurp them up, and we would all yell, "Gross!" And he loved it. But here, in Tokyo, Stephen was bragging to me how he would eat anything at the sushi bar. While we were eating at the Okura Hotel, the sushi chefs overheard him and said, "We heard you'll eat anything," as they laughed. And Stephen proudly said yes and took the challenge. All of us kids egged him on, so he waited as the chefs said they had something special just for him. After a minute or two, they brought out a giant 5-inch-long centipede-looking creature with several legs, and it crawled across the sushi bar. All the chefs laughed and said, "It's called the dancing shrimp, and you eat it alive." We all screamed, and for the first time, Stephen looked like the tables had truly been turned on him. But he ate it, and I got so freaked out, I ran out of the restaurant, and he had to chase after me, still chewing on the live creature, struggling to get it down his throat. Each country had a world premiere, and each seemed crazier than the next. Something had crossed over in my not-so-simple life would be even less simple now. Nothing would be simple. But my love and relationship with Stephen has always stayed the same. I have always tried to be my best in his eyes, even when I went through hell and I was too embarrassed to face him. He didn't judge. He always encouraged me to be my wisest and my strongest. We have had many jokes and profound conversations over the years. I trust him with life advice, as I still to this day go to him for it. When he holds my daughters in his arms, I don't think there is a prouder moment for me. Because this one man believed in my silly stories, he made me feel like I could do anything. He single-handedly opened all the doors in my life with that one decision of putting me in that film. It was my duty not to screw up the opportunity he gave me. And although I have struggled here and there, my respect for him and that experience always kept me humble and focused. I have always been motivated to live the best life I can. The School of E.T. was magical. Thank you, Stephen. Always and forever. Bronco. My car didn't have a name per se. It was just a metaphor for my life. Wild. Bull in China shop. Reckless. I was around 17 and still living in West Hollywood, going on auditions again while trying to revive my career, but not in any spotlight. It was just me and my Bronco. The amazing thing about the late 80s into the early 90s was there was no internet, no digital cameras. If you wanted to share a picture, you would have to go and develop it and then actually go and present it in person. And no one cared. It was the only period of my life where everyone was in their own bubble and widespread voyeurism had not yet come about, and the sharing just wasn't there. I picked out my two-tone car with a navy blue bottom and a tan hardtop because it looked like a big box and I liked cars that were high up, short woman's complex, and it made me feel like a badass. I fitted it with a CB radio and an illegal megaphone that came out the front below the grill, and you could shout crazy things and give people a real jump. I loved it. Again, I was not in my oversensitive phase where I was worried about where my life was headed. I could be an 80s child star footnote or something else, and for now, I didn't know which way it was all going, and for that moment in time only, I didn't care. I just loved hanging out with my two best friends, Justine and Mel. Justine and I were roommates, and we had a little house up in the hills. We would go out, party, paint, smoke cigarettes, and take Polaroids. That's what we did. It was Los Angeles, and we had a lot of friends, and all of them were at the beginning of their exciting lives, too. Some of the coolest filmmakers and biggest movie stars would come hang out at our house, but they hadn't become those things yet. We were all in the incubation process and in the last carefree time of our lives. We were human Polaroids, slowly developing into what other people would see, but for now, we were just scrappy kids in no rush to grow up. I would tool around LA in my big Bronco, just going along with the wind in my hair. I don't even remember what I did during the day. Some days, the highlight would be staying in the cabin while going through the car wash and watching the soap bubbles fall down the windshield. It was a total blur. Nighttime is when everything would come alive, as if I was just waiting for the sky to change color and the days didn't really matter. I slept late, and I wasn't expected anywhere, and I didn't really have anything to do. My responsibilities were to make sure that the car was filled up with gas and to have a good mixtape in the car stereo. And so we would drive around playing pranks on people in the hills. Mel would get on the megaphone and say, "Pull over! Pull over! This is the Deer Patrol, and you're endangering them with your driving! Pull over!" And the scared driver would comply, and then we would drive by laughing. What idiots we were. Sometimes, I admit, I would simply pick up my handheld mic and tell someone that they were just driving like an asshole and to have a nice day. I was merciless on that thing. It gave a driver a voice that we are clearly not meant to have behind the wheel. I bypassed the rules and drove around town like a total jerk. But I was having so much fun. Sometimes we would just catcall boys. Hey, if they can, then we thought we should be able to as well. One night, on New Year's Eve, we were at a music show on the Sunset Strip, some hipster band, although that term was not yet in full use, but it was a fun riot, and I left feeling invincible, as one does after a good rock show. I went to get my Bronco out of the parking lot down the street, only to realize it was closed. And I mean closed. Big, giant, 20-foot-high gate with no signs of life. We had more fun parties to go to, and I was not taking this lying down. Justine and Mel watched as I defied the laws of gravity and climbed the gate and hurled myself over it. I found my car and opened my baby and got in the driver's seat and jammed it in reverse. Now, I could have just jumped in a cab. They're all over Sunset Boulevard. But it would have never crossed my mind because my Bronco is my security blanket in the world. I felt safe in this metal box. It was a part of me. Life wasn't fun without my Bronco. And so I drove it slowly up to the gate. I saw Justine and Mel standing, waiting on the other side with the headlights in their eyes. I knew in my mind we could get out of here. That giant gate was in no way going to hinder me taking my car and continuing our evening. I stared at the gate, engine running. I contemplated how I would do this. I deduced that the first step would be to go back as far as I could and then jam it into drive. In my vision, I would just hit the gate with one quick slam, like ripping off a Band-Aid, and the force would just pop it open. It would literally be quick and precise, and that would be that. Bam! Literally. And so I did. I rolled back slowly with a glint in my eye as I looked out the windshield and zeroed in on my target. I grabbed the steering wheel gear shift and put it into drive. I took a deep breath and jammed on the gas. I knew I would have to slam on the brakes really quick, too, because once I broke through that gate, I would be on Sunset Boulevard in the blink of an eye. So I drove with 2 feet. As I sailed through the parking lot, I got closer and closer, and I asked myself if I should just slam on the brake and call it quits. No way, was my answer, and into the gate I drove. Justine and Mel looked like they were eating a lemon as they scrunched their faces awaiting impact. My Bronco went right into the gate with a gnarly metal tearing crash. And instead of popping it open like a button, my hood forced the bottom of the gate up and it went flat like it was lying down all of a sudden. Okay. Now the gate was officially horizontal rather than vertical, and I quickly contemplated my next move. A crowd was starting to gather around to see what that crazy noise was. I quickly jammed it into reverse to get out from under it, and I was back at my starting point. At this moment, I should have called it quits. But something took over, and I knew this gate was no challenge for my Bronco and me. I took leave of my senses and went for a second run. When I rammed the gate again, this time the tiny crowd cheered like kids at a party in an 80s movie. The part where somebody does something really nuts, but everyone encourages it. No movement on the gate, however. It was angled 10 degrees farther up, looking like someone lying in traction. I reversed again. The crowd started getting bigger. I mean, it was a bunch of drunken people cruising Sunset Boulevard on New Year's Eve. You couldn't ask for a greater audience to cheer on a crazy girl driving her Bronco through a gate because she had to get to the next party. Another hit. This time, the gate looked like it was just falling backwards. Of course, I couldn't see what my car looked like in front. I just saw that the gate was about to go down in this boxing ring. One more giant punch and this thing was hitting the floor with no signs of rejoining the fight. I was irrational and totally without good judgment, let alone any judgment at all. By this time, the crowd was chanting. My girlfriends were just looking at me like they knew I had this in me, but this was too far. They were not as crazy as me. I reversed back and took my last big breath. I got the car going by getting the gas pedal down while I still had my foot on the brake so that when I released it, I would be going at full speed. I raced forward and took out this motherfucking gate once and for all. It officially went up and over my hood and lay in my rearview mirror on the ground, lifeless and mangled. The crowd went wild! I looked out the windshield to people high-fiving and cheering. Rearview mirror, lifeless gate. Windshield, party. It was a polarity like no other. The cheering eventually died down and people dispersed, going back to their own New Year's Eve world. But no one documented it. I never heard anything about it. It was just a crazy moment that got to be a crazy moment. My girlfriends got in the car and off we went. I didn't know how to feel. The only thing I did feel was pride for my car. I knew we were unstoppable. The next morning, in the light of day, I surveyed my beloved Bronco. I wasn't a day person to begin with, but this day was particularly bright and God was showing me what I had done. The damage was really bad. The whole front of the car looked like it had gone through a paper shredder. I felt stupid and embarrassed. Is this who I was? Child star footnote, here we come. Yikes. I took the car to the dealership, driving into the lot with my head down and my tail between my legs. I didn't have parents to shame me, so I was doing that to myself. And that really was the crux of the problem. I was still a kid with no guidance. I only had myself. And that's why I always feel so guilty when I'm wrong, because I am the only person to catch it and make a case for being better. I was at such odds inside myself because I knew there was a part of me that wanted to ram cars and feel invincible. But I also knew there was a part of me that understands there is, at best, a time and place for that. Being an actor, I could fantasize myself into any lifestyle or any person. And at this moment, I was in full agreement that I needed a more productive channel than just me and my Bronco. I sat at the dealership on a hot day in the San Fernando Valley thinking, I need a new car and I need a new life. The Blue Angel. There was a club in New York called the Blue Angel. It was in the bowels of the Lower East Side, and my friends and I frequented it. It was a dingy performance art place with one small stage and soft lighting. My one friend, John, had developed an alter ego as Dick Haney, the world's worst comedian. And one night, as he was doing a stand-up routine on stage, I spontaneously decided to join him during his set, which was as amateur as anything you can picture. I gave myself the name Lolita and jumped onto the stage. As the bit went on, I was inspired to dance around like an old 60s movie go-go dancer in slow motion and take off my clothes piece by piece behind him. As this was a place for performance art, I seemed to do just that. At the point when I was like a little wood nymph behind him, we both realized it was time to wrap it up and have the curtain fall. In the snap of a finger, it was over, and our wild little show was over before it began. I was in a very free state in my life. This is something I struggle with as a mom because now that I have grown up, I couldn't feel more passionate about being appropriate. Everything in my world is about being appropriate. People ask me, what are you going to tell your daughters about some parts of your life? I don't want to have to lie, but I am much more invested in telling them how I found my values. I had to discover for myself what was tasteful or not. I ran through fields and on beaches naked. I was even in magazines in my amazing time of self-discovery. I was posing on the cover of Rolling Stone and